to our spring term, 1985. This boyish man on my left will, with his professional enthusiasm, excite a new interest in you, in the archaeology of the Pacific Rim. And I'll ask Professor Richard Joseph Pearson to speak in a moment, and I'll introduce him. But first, I'd like to make a remark on the passing of a good and longtime supporter of the Vancouver Institute. As we commence the last half of our 69th season, it's only proper to remark on the contribution that Dean Emeritus Frederick Soward, 1900-1985, made to the Institute. Fred joined UBC at the age of 23 in 1923. UBC was then housed in the shacks at Fairview. He was very quickly a supporter of the Institute, and while a vice president in 1947-48, was a member of the executive until his death, which is a span of nearly 40 years. For many years, some of you will remember, he gave an annual address to the Institute on International Affairs. Now, he'll be greatly missed. I want to give a word as well about membership. All of it's good, and it should cheer you. I'll give it the three categories, comparisons between this year and last year. Students this year, 114, compared to 58, which is a gain of 56, and I think the most important category. Single memberships, 235 compared to 211, a gain of 24. Family memberships, 338 to 316, a gain of 22. So altogether, we have a gain of 102 in the memberships over this time last year. Now, it's important for me to say again that while we welcome memberships, the lectures are free. I've had two people call who I would have thought would have known better to ask permission to come. We love to have your memberships. It's not necessary for you to belong. We want both your memberships and your donations if you can afford it. Now, a word about our speaker. You should know that he's a Canadian, born in Kitchener, 1938, has been tenured at UBC for 12 years, since the spring of 1973. He's a very valuable person to our academic community. He estimates that within the whole of North America, there are no more than six academics at his level. Canada's fortunate in having three of them in the country, one at McGill, one at the University of Toronto, and Professor Pearson here. The technical challenge in respect of Asian archaeology is that in order to make progress in the field, one should be competent in the language. It's an enormous additional academic burden, of course. In times of restraint, you should know, and I should remind you, that we have an extremely good Asian library. It took decades of building, and it's a tribute to those who went before Professor Pearson in anthropology. He tells me that we used to be somewhere between 7th and 10th in the world, about the level of a good municipal library or rural library in Japan, which is very, very good indeed. And it's a struggle to maintain, and that's why I mention it. A great deal of new work is being done, and these results being published, of course, that adds to the cost. In our talk, Professor Pearson told me laughingly about American colleagues who were so concerned about staying current that they pay for all their subscriptions and papers to be airmailed to them. Our speaker took his BA at the University of Toronto in 1960 and went directly on to do his PhD at Yale. In the course of the time that he was at Yale, he did a year in Okinawa and a year in Taiwan. He took his doctorate in 1966, taught 5 years at the University of Hawaii, joined UBC in 1971, and was tenured very shortly after. At the time that he joined UBC, and I should tell you this, there was a one half-year course in anthropology, and that was an option at the fourth-year level. At UBC today, we have and British Columbia at that time, those of you who are old enough to remember, was very Europe-oriented, not Pacific Rim-oriented. We now have a world-class museum in the Museum of Anthropology, where our speaker was for 3 years curator, a very mature department, deep in the span of required of the discipline, so that our speaker represents the very best of the second wave of archaeologists to be hosted by UBC. So I asked Professor Pearson to speak to you tonight on his topic of recent Asian archaeological discovery. Professor Pearson. Sunday.
Great. That sounds good. Thank you very much, Richard, for the introduction. I am most appreciative for your description of how things have grown and developed at UBC. I should make one very minor correction. In 1971, there was one archaeology course. There were many anthropology courses. There was one archaeology course, and since then, the archaeology offerings have been expanded a great deal. So for those of you who studied anthropology in the 60s, I don't want you to feel that somehow we were slighting the work that was being done, the major work that was being done at that time. Archaeology remains, to me at least, one of the very best ways that we can gain information about the past. Now, obviously, I'm prejudiced. I'm sure any historian would say that history provides much more than archaeology can provide. However, archaeology is important because it provides us with such tangible evidence. Not always easy evidence to interpret, but some very, very substantial factual evidence. What I've become interested in as I've looked at East Asia is the way in which the societies of this region, as they grow, they feed themselves and sustain themselves on their cultural heritage. Now, any society does this. But I think societies which have very, very long literate histories tend to work and rework their past to make it suit their needs of the present and to gain sustenance from this. We all look back on our own national heritage of various kinds, our Canadian heritage, as a means of establishing who we are, how we relate to other people, and how we'll solve problems that we face in the future. These countries all over the world, including us, any society, uses historical facts and also the subjective interpretation of the facts to form an image of themselves in the modern world. And tonight, what I would like to do is to present you with a kind of array of bonbons, in a way, of goodies, of treasures from East Asia, from China, from Japan, and from Korea. And in addition to having you appreciate the objects for themselves, I would like to try to set them into some kind of social context. I'd like to talk about what these discoveries mean to us and to the people of Asia, for the understanding of the way in which their societies have come to be. And I would also like to look at these remains from the point of view of how different countries which have evolved in East Asia, the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Koreans in particular, have viewed their interrelationships. We're going to look at 10 major finds. And to assist you, I have a map which has been prepared. You'll notice tonight some very, very fine graphics, I hope, I like them, done by Moira Irvin from our archaeology lab. There is no way that I personally could visit all of the sites that I will show you or gather the photographs firsthand. But we're very lucky at UBC to have someone who can prepare photographs for us from various kinds of publications. As I go along, I'll be talking a little bit about the way in which each country does its archaeology. And I hope in the end that this journey will be useful for us in reflecting about our own heritage and the value that we put on our own archaeological record. So I'll start with a map that'll show us where we're going. We're going to jump around a bit in China. It will be a quick tour. We'll then come back to the map again before we embark to Japan and to Korea. Oops, there we are. First of all, we're going to be looking at a new discovery near the city of Shanghai. a site of the Liangzhu culture. We'll come back to these names. Some of them may be a little bit unfamiliar at first. Then we're going to move to North China to look at the tomb of the Lady Fu Hao, and also up almost to Beijing to look at the sites of the Zhongshan kings, the kings of the Zhongshan state. That's Zhongshan. Then we'll take the briefest possible stop in Xi'an. Many people are familiar with Xi'an. I can only add a little bit to the knowledge that most of us already have of the material there. And finally, we want to plunge deep into South China to a site within the city of Guangzhou in Canton, the site of what is called the Nanyue Kingdom, the find of a new tomb of the Han Dynasty, which expands our knowledge of Chinese archaeology considerably. Now, later on, we'll be looking at Japan, several places in Japan, and then finally, we'll end up looking at two rather spectacular finds in Korea. Oops, sorry, this is a laser, and I'm warned I can zap people out of existence with this thing, apparently. And finally, we'll look at the richest underwater discovery ever made, a ship loaded with thousands of porcelains and tons of Chinese coins. So first of all, we'll start with a very interesting discovery, which has just been reported in the last little while. You might say, why don't I start with the finds of fossil proto-humans from China that go back to 10 million years? Or how about the cave of Peking Man at something like 400,000 years? I've chosen to start at a point where Chinese society, that is the human organization, rather than the physical characteristics, becomes of predominant interest. And this is a burial of a male about 20 years old. The burial was made sometime around 2500 BC in the area near Shanghai, a place called Sidun. It's actually within the city limits. What's interesting about this site is that for its early date, this is long before the establishment of the first states or civilizations or kingdoms in China, it's extremely rich. It's literally loaded with jade objects, 57 jade objects, buried in a rather unusual ritual. These objects are of two kinds primarily, and oblong, square, perforated objects that we refer to as the zong. Now, what's interesting about this is this enormous concentration of wealth around this one rather young person. Anthropologists would ask, why was this person buried with such wealth? What is also interesting is that it's the first expression of Chinese jade working on this scale. We know that the Chinese began jade working very early, and we also know that it began in the Shanghai area, in the Yangtze area. And this discovery has become particularly unusual. It is not yet very well described in the literature, but I think it's worth our taking a look at. This is what the archaeologists found. The bones of the individual were not in very good condition, but they found this strange array of these two kinds of jade ornaments. Many of you will recognize the round discs. They're found often in the later periods in the Han Dynasty. Now we have them among elaborate farming communities existing in the third millennium. So this is pushing back the use of jade and the use of the jade in the rituals. If you follow Chinese archaeology and the jade burial suits of the emperors, you may have seen these in the exhibitions held in various places. Here we can see the first account of covering somebody in jade. This is happening as early as 2500 BC. It gives us some kind of feeling, I think, for the depth of the Chinese tradition and for the way in which it's built up stage by stage. Here's what the archaeologists think happened. First of all, the mourners put 10 jade discs on the ground along with 3 perforated axes. Then they burned the area intensely. As the fire was about to go out, they placed the corpse on the jades. Then they placed the jade zong, these rectangular objects, around the man, 4 below the feet, 27 around the person, and one squarely in front of his face. Then they placed pottery vessels into the area. What's interesting is that no pit was dug. This was placed on the surface of the ground, and the individual was covered by a mound. Next, they placed jade and stone tools at the right side and by the left arm of the individual. And finally, there was a huge necklace of tubular beads, which was placed all around the burial. And what seems to be interesting is that the necklace seems to have been rent at the time of burial, so that the beads were scattered and one bead was deliberately put into a pottery vessel. Now, it's really very hard at this point to understand the meaning of this ritual. But it's interesting, that I think, to find that the archaeologists are now becoming interested in pushing back the study of the religion of the later periods through looking at these Neolithic discoveries. Up until now, it's been rare for us to find such an example in such good condition, and to be able to interpret the different steps of the ritual based on a careful removal of these artifacts one by one. This is really the first time that we can see some of these very, very fine jade objects. They were thought originally to belong to the Shang Dynasty, to the Bronze Age of the second millennium. They're pushed back now hundreds of years. And so for those who always wondered about whether Chinese civilization might have come from across the steppes of Central Asia, or it might have somehow been introduced from outside China, this is one more piece of evidence that the Chinese archaeologists used to show the indigenous development of Chinese traditions and Chinese civilization. We'll hear a lot more, I think, about this discovery. It's just been published within the last while. It really is true that the people who work fastest in this field, my professor, Zhang Guangzhi, and others working in this area, get all of their journals by airmail, because Chinese archaeology moves so fast that you can be out of print in a month, or out of date in a month on this field. And so it's very important to keep up with the new discoveries. Now, the second site I wanted to look at is one that some of you people may know about. I've been waiting to introduce my only good pun of the evening. I don't want you to become too jaded this evening. But I promise you I don't have any more. I've tried hard this week, but I couldn't think of any other good ones. Many of you may have heard of some of these discoveries, but I think in each case I may be able to add a little bit. In the late 70s, the Chinese found the first undisturbed royal tomb of the Shang Dynasty. They had found 11 tombs previously, but they had all been badly rifled. And in a place where they didn't expect, where they were digging actually for an irrigation system, outside the small town of Anyang, north of the Yellow River, they found the tomb that turned out to be the burial of the wife of one of the Shang emperors. Now, this dates to about the 12th century BC, so we've come down a long way from our last discovery. We're now down to the 12th century BC. And the scale of this tomb is interesting, I think, in comparison to what we saw of the Liangzhu culture. This tomb contains 755 jade objects, 200 bronze ceremonial vessels. Now, if you've seen one bronze ceremonial vessel in a museum or the collection in Toronto, for instance, or Seattle, you'll know how precious they are. Now we have some idea of the scale of the burial of these first rulers of the first states in China. That is when the actual stage at which Chinese society had reached state level. These bronze vessels came in huge sets. I could just imagine the Lady Fu Hao giving a big party. She had 50 bronze beakers, 40 goblets. These seem to have been used perhaps in the burial ritual. And one of the best studies, by the way, of this tomb was done by a UBC student, Ken Kwok, who wrote a very, very penetrating multidisciplinary study on this tomb last year. One of the bronze vessels weighs 117 kilograms. Now, those of you who have heard Ursula Franklin speak in this series last year will remember how she mentioned just how difficult it is to cast these very, very large bronze objects, which were cast in one pouring in piece molds. 16 people accompanied Lady Fu Hao in death. This is the euphemism the Chinese use. Now, in later Shang, the situation gets worse. There are hundreds, actually, who are sacrificed with some of the rulers. In her case, four of these people were children, and there were some male and female. Actually, they're not too sure because the preservation wasn't terribly good in some cases. She was also buried with 6,000 cowrie shells. Cowries functioned as money in ancient China. They were a scarce, controllable commodity. You couldn't go and counterfeit them in your backyard, so they were good to use for money, right? Because they had to come from far away in the tropics. The jade objects from this tomb are particularly interesting, but also some of the other sorts of crafts that we can see. This is a large double food cooking vessel that came from her tomb, one of the most famous, very, very fine casting. And we are lucky to have whole sets of these to study rather than having simply single examples which have been looted, as was the case earlier. So we're now learning a great deal about the arrangement of the materials. Fu Hao in her tomb had things which had been given to her by officials from surrounding principalities, showing that even though she was the wife of the emperor, she had very, very important power on her own. She also had her own army. She was a very, very important lady, and through the study of Fu Hao, some people are learning a great deal now about the social organization of the Shang. This is a rather unusual piece. It's elephant ivory. And you may ask, how come elephants? Well, the climate was warmer in North China at that time, and elephants are thought to have actually inhabited the area. They may have been scarce, however, and they may have been traded. The ivory may have been traded. I think there's a better shot showing the work on this piece. This is an intact one in ivory inlaid with turquoise. So this shows the level. The anthropologists like to talk about the sophisticated level of craft specialization by this time period. In other words, there were whole groups of people being supported by the royalty to produce these sumptuary objects for use in ritual and burial. And one of my interesting observations or suspicion I have is that this impetus given to the production of sumptuary items by the Chinese royalty, I think, is one of the propelling factors in the movement of Chinese technology so rapidly, that many things were not made first for utilitarian purposes at all, but were made as very, very special ornaments or gadgets for the elite. And through the manufacture of these, various kinds of technological breakthroughs came. I think it has something to do with the nature of the state in China, but I can't articulate this very well at this point. This is not the world's first wind-up toy. That's on the back, that's part of her sash. And in fact, she almost looks like a Japanese Maiko in a way with her very elaborate sash and her hairstyle. These are parts of the hundreds of jade objects that were buried with Fu Hao. Actually, the archaeologists have had to admit that when they got to the bottom of the excavation, the water table in this area had been raised through irrigation in the last few decades, and they were working in a slurry of mud. And they're not absolutely sure where every object comes from in relation to every other object. Archaeologists don't like to have to admit this, but this does seem to be the case in the Fu Hao tomb. So the precise position of some of these jades is not absolutely clear. But you notice the decoration. Also, a rather strange face here. Many of the jades of this time period have a sort of combined animal-human countenance, which seems to have been common in Shang art. This piece I find absolutely incredible for several accounts. One thing is it's only 10 centimeters high. Now, that means it's only 4 inches high. The other thing is it looks like a bronze vessel, but it's jade. So someone has made a jade object to look like a bronze vessel. And again, the ingenuity of it, I think, is fascinating. Many of my slides don't have scales with them, and so sometimes it's hard to tell the actual size. But this is a rather tiny piece, then, which has been made to look like bronze, but the entire piece is carved in jade. Remember that jade carving involves abrading, right? We can't chip the jade. We don't have the drills and tools that we have today, so this would have been done with sand and bamboo and abrasive stones of various kinds. And the amount of labor represented in these assemblages is absolutely enormous. Some of these wonderful small bird objects, there are animals of all kinds. There's really a whole field to study from the Lady Fu Hao's tomb. And it's very significant, I think, that the Chinese publish rapidly. Another thing I'm very interested in is that they very often publish a general account, which is available for general readers, and a highly technical account. In North America, we don't have such a great record of doing this. We tend to produce archaeological reports that we often joke. The middle part between the introduction and the conclusion is read by the writer and the editor. Students and others read the introduction and then skip all the description and go to the end, unless they're fanatics. But what we find with China is a great emphasis on presenting the archaeological materials to the general public. This is just a sort of filler. I did want to mention some of the kinds of digging that the Chinese have done. These are burials of chariots, horses and chariots put into pits in the ground. The horses killed and then all covered over. They have recently found one that I think would absolutely terrify our sort of SPCA, 600 horses in a line, all buried and as part of a burial with a Zhou Dynasty emperor. Now, if you can simply imagine the logistics, I can't cope with lining up these 600 horses and getting them down into the ramp, into this burial, and then getting them all to sort of conk out and lie down and fill the whole thing in. It's simply on a scale that I find very hard to cope with. Also, if you've learned in your archaeology courses about the poor archaeologists who have to draw every bone that lies in the excavation, you can think of the people who ended up in the horse pit of the Zhou Dynasty drawing the skeletons of 600 horses. You'd know your horse skeletons pretty well, I think, by the end. Now, if we move on to a rather interesting discovery, which is right now on display in France at the Grand Palais, and some of you may have seen the newspaper accounts of this. This is a very unusual, striking series of finds made in North China in the Hebei Plain, that is in the area right around Beijing. And what they found there in digging an irrigation system in the last few years is the remains of a state that existed around 400. Actually, they only lasted, that's 400 BC, in the period that we call the Warring States period of China. This is a period when the tight hierarchical rule of the Shang emperors, whose consort we saw, Lady Fu Hao, that sort of rule was crumbling. We have all kinds of local principalities emerging, competing with each other. We have people who are not of royal descent assuming power. It's a chaotic period. As we know, the Chinese like to say, may you live in interesting times. And this was one of them. This is the time period when many of the important ancient Chinese philosophers lived, generally the time period of Confucius, of Laozi, of Zhuangzi. And this one state in the north, the state of Zhongshan, is interesting for several reasons. These people were nomadic minority people who came across the Great Wall. Actually, at that time, the Great Wall wasn't complete, but pieces of it were. And they settled down in the Hebei Plain, and they became what we would call Sinicized. That is, they fitted into the Chinese system quite well. Their tombs, 60 of them, have been found. And I'm interested in these because I think they give us some idea of the enormous diversity within China. I find this diversity absolutely boggling. I also find the way in which all the pieces have fitted together to make Chinese, modern Chinese culture or civilization very interesting. Now, some of the objects that have been found are these pottery vessels. Any of you who are interested in ceramics, I think, would find these intriguing. These are not metal. These are pottery objects which have been burnished to look like metal. So they rub the surfaces. They shine like as if they were made out of metal. I first saw these displayed in Japan, actually, two or three years ago. It's interesting that some of the best ways to see Chinese archaeology is to wait for the material to be exhibited in Japan. Often the Japanese will exhibit it in an extremely elaborate fashion with very, very good didactic aids. And this display was accompanied by a huge catalog. As only the Japanese could do, it comes in its own shopping bag. And you carry it away, you sort of stagger out of the exhibit with it. Now, some of the objects from this are particularly unusual. For the Trans-Pacific contacts people, I don't believe in contact between China and Mexico, and I don't know how I can introduce this when I'm so nervous about having to field questions on this. But here's your Snakes and Ladders or your Parcheesi, if you're interested in making comparisons between China and the New World. It's a game. It's a board for a game called Liu Bu, which is a backgammon kind of game, apparently. The whole thing is carved in jade. And it occurred in one of the burials. Another thing that was found in one of these burials was a map to all of the royal tombs produced in bronze with gold inlay. So there's a treasure map, in a sense. You can imagine the Arkis finding this and saying, now we know where to dig, in a way. However, I don't think that's what it was originally intended for. But it's of particular interest, I think, for understanding the way in which these people symbolized, the way in which they conceived this whole enterprise of burying the royal dead. Now, some of the other objects that have been found are intriguing. This one in particular. If you had to interpret that as an archaeologist, what might it be? Well, actually, they found some drawings and etchings on Han bronze vessels. What this is the top piece of an enormous tent. So these people had brought their yurts with them from the north. So all of the ropes go out from this. And the pieces for the tent, which were all the bronze fittings, which could all be collapsible and carried, are all there in one of the burials. So again, we get some idea of these very different lifestyles of people living within China. There's a diagram of how it would work. You know, really quite sophisticated, I think, quite similar to what we might have today. I'm glad that I wasn't the archaeologist to find that, because I think I would have called it some ceremonial or ritual object of unknown use. But they were able to come out and figure out what it was from their vast knowledge of the representations of other things which have been found. This is a silver lamp, which again comes apart in pieces. And the face of the individual here is worked silver, cast silver, with semi-precious stone eyes. Again, really, really different, I think, from the kinds of things that we're used to seeing from this period in Chinese art. These are really rather strange kinds of things. But I think they show us the diversification of Chinese metallurgy in the last millennium BC. Now, I hesitate to mention the great warrior pits of the Qin Dynasty, because everybody knows about these. These are the offering pits which were put around the mausoleum of the great emperor Qin Shi Huang, who lived in the 3rd century BC. And he was the person who unified China. He standardized weights and measures. He actually, another thing I think he did, which is brilliant, was he standardized the distance between the wheels of chariots. You can imagine if you were an upper-class person living in 4th century China and you were bumping along over the countryside in your chariot and you crossed the tracks left by the elite from the next state over and they weren't the same width as yours, you would get your teeth jarred out practically, right, going through those ruts. So what Qin Shi Huang did was to establish uniform dimensions for chariots, uniform dimensions for weighing things, for coinage, for all sorts of things. Now, he lived in some 12 to 15 palaces. He migrated from palace to palace. When his palaces burned, it took 3 months for the fire to stop. So that's the level. And hundreds of thousands of people were killed under him. So he's a kind of controversial figure. And what I want to mention to you, I think most of you have heard of these actually slightly larger than life-size terracotta figures. This is not a good photograph of them. Photographs by people who visit the site are prohibited, right? The Chinese are very concerned that they own their cultural properties. This is a topic I'm very, very interested in and would like to pursue a lot further at some point. They're worried about foreigners coming in and taking very, very fine quality pictures and then publishing them and profiting from them. They believe that they should do that first, then other countries should do this. The big danger, of course, has always been the Japanese, who came in very quickly when China was opened up, took brilliant photographs, and published huge series on Chinese archaeology before the Chinese could get mobilized. And so now what we see are joint publication projects between China and Japan, in which Japan provides the technical work, but the profits don't all go outside of China. Now, the one example I want to show you, though, tonight, this is simply one of the figures. If you haven't seen some of them, they're very, very fine. They're each face on 7,000 figures is hand-modeled. And the weapons that they found with these people are made of bronze, and the bronze has apparently a deliberately high lead content. They were aware of the fact that if they could make arrowheads, for instance, other small items that would get lodged in people, and they had large quantities of lead in them, that they could poison people. So they were already at that level in their sort of military technology. The Qin are a fantastic subject all unto themselves. But what I want to show you tonight is the discovery of a third pit, actually, in the ground. I think you can see the archaeologist working down here in the pit. And these contain two chariots with four horses each made of bronze. They've been cast and then assembled. That means all the pieces, there are hinges on some of them, there are soldering in others, there are all sorts of ways of putting together these chariots. And the Chinese, again, I am absolutely overwhelmed by their technical ability to restore these materials and to present them a few years after. You can say, well, a few years is a long time, but archaeologists generally work quite slowly, and it takes an enormous amount of manpower to do this. And in this case, they have reconstructed this chariot, which perhaps the emperor himself may have traveled in. Shortly after this time period, we know of chariots that have odometers and chariots that have compasses on them so that they could set the direction that they would travel, or they would know their direction in relation to where they were traveling. This one is 3.1 meters long, so it's it's quite a large replica, and it's 1 meter high. So it's really quite a feat, I think, to see the way in which this thing has been put together with the horses. There's also, for people who work on the history of horsemanship, of the way in which the horses are attached to the chariot, there are fascinating details. There's also been a whole study on the military organization of the Qin dynasty based on the different uniforms, which can all be very, very carefully interpreted from these clay figures. They're totally accurate. They show different hairstyles, different badges, different kinds of armor of the different ranks of the Qin army, which was, at its time, the most feared in Eastern Asia. Now, next I want to move to an intriguing discovery in South China, in the city of Canton. This is right in the city. Actually, I'm told that it's in one of the large parks. Oops, having some trouble. Let's see what we've got here. Focus. Let's see. We don't seem to have our own focus.
Something wrong with the focus.
This dragon's trying to escape on us, I think. This is a discovery that was made actually in 83. And it comes from a really, really interesting episode in Chinese history. The Qin invaded Canton. And one of their generals, who was a man, I have this image, this great northerner from Hebei. You could imagine him way down in South China. His name was Zhao Tuo. And he decided that he was going to split from the Qin and set up his own country, as a number of Chinese military figures did at this time period. And so he established his own country called Nanyue. Now, the name is interesting because it exists in modern history as Vietnam. There are many, many stories about, you know, the relations of these. But anyway, it's not a direct relationship. But he set up a country in South China, and it lasted for three generations. And then it was absorbed into China again. And when Zhao Tuo died, apparently. I love these stories. I think they're very, very Chinese, and I really believe them because I think the history has shown this to be accurate in so many cases. Five funeral processions left the city of Guangzhou in five directions. So no one had any idea which one contained Zhao Tuo. And he was buried. And for 300 years after, apparently all through the Three Kingdoms period, thousands of people searched for that burial because they knew it was loaded with goodies. And they never found it. And in more recent times, Chinese archaeologists actually hunted for it. But what they found was Zhao Tuo's son's tomb. And it's one of these things that we tend to call the Digong, that is the underground palace. I don't have any pictures of the site itself. Those haven't been published yet. But this is a structure which is 20 meters deep, 60 feet, and these are quite common in the Han Dynasty. It has 24 roof slabs over it. It's 10 meters long, and it has a series of rooms in it. And I really like this too. When the Chinese found it, they opened up an area that is 30 centimeters by 30 centimeters. That's a foot by a foot. And they lowered some poor Chinese archaeologist through that with a flashlight. Now, you know, I don't know who's got 12-inch hips or shoulders, but you can imagine being lowered through into this tomb on a rope with a flashlight. And he came up and said, "It's intact. This is one of them. You know, we really hit this time." Now, I don't want to be snide, but nowadays, in many countries, what we do is we put a remote sensing equipment through. But if you don't have the remote sensing, I think, you know, better put an archaeologist through than dig up this whole thing and wait to see what you're going to find. Now, they knew that with the tombs of this level, with the emperors, for instance, any of you who have seen the Ming tombs or heard about them will know that when they finished the burial, they had a way of letting off a trigger that slammed the door shut so it could never be opened. It has weights on it. There's no way you can get that door to open. Nothing will open it. So what they had to do was dig down under the door and attach ropes to it and pull it straight up with a crane. You can imagine the logistics of doing this sort of thing. You know, archaeologists have to be engineers as well, I think, to do some of these things. When they got in, they found that there were 1,000 objects, including two sets of musical chime stones. You know that for many of the sites of this time period, these have been found, actually. They found all kinds of food put in. There's one dish, apparently, with 100 tiny birds, neatly roasted, all with the feet and heads taken off. So these were really dainty morsels for this emperor. They must have had to prepare a little bit fast. This person must have passed away a little bit sooner than they expected because the stove that's put into the burial chamber apparently still has parts of the mold stuck to it. So you can imagine the Imperial Household Agency saying, "Look, the funeral's tomorrow. You better get that stove here." And somebody, you know, busy preparing these objects for the burials. Now, there are a number of jades which are particularly interesting. The seal is, I think, quite important. This is an imperial seal. It has the imperial dragon on it. And the seals themselves are a whole study because I have another example here of a seal. Actually, these are the characters on the bottom of this particular seal. And what the archaeologists are interested in is that these people, we seem to have vanishing problems tonight with these. Maybe it'll come back. See, there it comes. See? Look at that. These seals are interesting because they show that these people were apparently of the imperial level, and yet we've never excavated an imperial tomb of the Han Dynasty. So the comparison is still not absolutely sure. There were the remains of a jade bodysuit in this burial as well, the whole jade covering in which the individual was buried.
Any luck? Not working either.
Let's see. What can we do? We have...
further straight.
What if I use... no? Film... I've got everything... don't seem to have any focus. No. I wonder why these are doing that. There we go. Very good. Great. Now, why are these seals so interesting? Well, by the time we get to the Han, we're dealing with the imperial level of organization. This is as complex as Imperial Rome. One of the things we notice is that the seals very clearly indicate the status of these people. So these very elaborate seals with the dragon on it, for instance, are very different from the kinds of seals that we see given by the Han to the countries around them. This is a seal that was given to a chief in Japan in the first century BC. It was actually found in 1784. And you'll notice right away the style is quite different. So what we can see here is a whole hierarchy. If we want to study other objects which are the finest of their kind, gilt, bronze objects, vessels, some very, very fine ones, and jades of all kinds. Again, we've seen in China how many of these there are. And there's one here. This one, I think, is rather interesting with the hook on it. So it's part of a hook for a garment. There are also some which one of our students, Janet Lucas, who did her MA in our department and is now at University of Beijing, she found when she went through the literature on Canton Province that there were jade objects with handles on them, found in burials as well. And she's now pursuing this study in Beijing. This is a horn cup of jade as well from this particular tomb. Now, we've looked at a number of these Chinese finds. Let's switch quickly to Japan. We're going to look at an area outside of Osaka. Another area, actually, we're going to start off with a site at Otsuka, which is outside of Yokohama. And we're going to look just briefly at three Japanese areas before we turn finally to Korea. I'd like to say, first of all, before we start on Japan, that the situation in Japanese archaeology is quite different from Chinese in that we're able at this point to interact at quite a different level. Now, China is changing a lot, and we have a lot of opportunities to go to Chinese universities and to work with the Chinese, but still the situation is a relatively complex one in that the Chinese are reluctant to show us things which are not totally published, and they're in some cases a little bit guarded as far as sharing with us the interpretations of material. We also don't know very much about what we call cultural resource management in China. How do they decide which sites to dig, which ones to save? What are their budgets? Who makes a decision, for instance, about digging up a certain site? In the Japanese case, of course, we're swamped with material, and it's all very, very explicit. Just a few figures to give you an idea of the scale of archaeology in Japan. Because I think it's often common for people who are interested in China to think of Japan somehow as a kind of diminutive copy. And I really feel that one of my missions in life is somehow to work at changing that image. The Japanese in 1982 spent $212 million Canadian on excavation alone. That's not the money they spent administering their museums, the money they spent working on other cultural activities. That's what they put in to saving archaeological sites that were threatened through economic development. Osaka Prefecture alone, that's one of 46 prefectures, right? 46 prefectures in Japan, spent $46 million. Now, very few people, I think, appreciate the level at which the Japanese are working on their archaeological heritage. There are many problems because it means that they are destroying what we call non-renewable resources at a very fast rate. They're digging things up because they need the land to develop it for other purposes. They are conserving, however. There are a number of cases where they found archaeological remains and sealed them and left them for the future without excavating them. The Chinese, by the way, are also doing this in a number of cases. We sometimes, I think, work on a very short time horizon. We have this idea that if it's there, we need it now. But these people have lived with these things for thousands of years, and they're not prepared in some cases to do this. There were 13,000 excavations in Japan in 1 year. And remember, that's a country that is 1/27th the size of Canada. Now, some of the digs that the Japanese have been doing, I just want to show you these for some idea of scale. Here's a whole village from the 1st century AD, excavated by the archaeologists. There's every house in that village and the surrounding ditch. So this whole thing is hundreds of meters long. They've cleared it off, and they've marked all of the posts from each house, and they have excavated the surrounding ditch around the house, around the whole village. So what we've got there is the beginnings of a kind of prehistoric anthropology or sociology. We can look at every house and see how it's related to every other house. Now, this is done a great deal in Europe. It's not unique to Japan, but the Japanese level of sophistication in field archaeology is probably unrivaled. I think they like to think that they're the best in the world at this point. And I think there's definitely some grounds for this. Now, when we look at, here's a plan of that village. See, they've actually got not only the village, but they have the cemetery. These things over here on the right are what we call sacred precincts. Each one of these is the burial, thought to be of a chief, perhaps, with little ditches put around it to separate it from the rest of the area. So here's a kind of ritual area which the archaeologists can study. Our scale here is 100 meters, so that gives you roughly some idea of the length of this thing that they have been working on. Now, the Japanese are also very sophisticated with technical analyses. They use a lot of geophysics in their archaeology. And one of the things that's just been discovered in the last little while is that these bronze bell-like objects, which come from what we call the Yayoi period, this is around the beginning of the Christian era, these are ritual objects. And what the Japanese have found, they've been doing lead isotope analysis of the bronze. And they've really come on something that's quite intriguing. The bronze is not of local origin. So what is happening, apparently, is that the Japanese were receiving through trade weapons or mirrors or other objects made in China and Korea, and then they were melting them down and making their own objects. And so already it gives us some idea of the links between the continent and Japan. It's hard for me to present these examples in such shorthand, but I wanted to give you a feeling for how many dimensions there are in this archaeology. So here's a new one that we're seeing, trade and geophysical study to look at the trade. These things only lasted, these strange bell-like things, which are unrelated apparently to the bells of China and Korea. They only lasted for about 100 years. And so there was some kind of religious movement, we think, which happened in Japan over this time period. And what's interesting is that they were using material which they were reworking. So for the history of the relationships of these people, I think this is kind of fascinating. We're going to see later what the Japanese discovered when they started X-raying pieces of rust from some sites. So hold your breath, it gets better. Now, this one is particularly interesting, I think, to give us some idea of the scale of Japanese archaeology. These five burial mounds date from the 5th century, and they come from Saga Prefecture down in Kyushu. Now, this is a relatively poor area of Japan, but it's interesting in terms of cultural resource management. The Japanese called in archaeologists who worked on these five burial mounds. Then they were going to be threatened by the road right-of-way. So they moved them 500 meters and then set them up again. And they exist as a park now. They've been made into a cultural interpretive center which people in this area can go and visit. There they are. Now, you can say, and this will be my concluding theme, that only foolish rich people do things like this. Well, I don't believe that. I believe that people who invest in this sort of thing get a return later. If your mind works in terms of money, and such, and whose doesn't, I think you'll find that what the Japanese are doing is putting enormous amounts of local money into what I like to call sort of non-polluting industry. What you do is you put the money into the development of cultural resources. And in this case, they've actually done this. Now, I mentioned this to my Japanese friends and said, this is simply fantastic. And they sneered and they said, it's no good at all. I said, what's wrong with it? He said, well, the burials up on the top there. We don't know whether that's accurate or not. And I said, well, I'll settle for, you know, a little bit of fudging on that if I could have this sort of interpretive facility. This has enormous potential for us in Canada, I think. The local archaeological museum at the site, not in Ottawa, not in Victoria, not in Vancouver, at the site. And what that does is it brings people to the area. It also reinforces the cultural identity of the people in that particular area. And the Japanese are doing an enormous amount of this. Some of them are really inexpensive. Some of them are nothing more than a sheet metal roof over a hole in the ground where archaeologists have worked. The Chinese are doing this. Sometimes all it is an iron gate across a cave where they dug so that no one can loot the site or in any way damage it. Now, in other cases, the Japanese have done things like putting a highway, a freeway, under an archaeological site. You can say, you know, this is amazing stuff. Another case in Okinawa that I know of, they saved an archaeological site by putting the road out into the reef, into the coral reef around the site. Now that one bothers me a bit because I have a feeling what they did was they mitigated the cultural resources and probably screwed up the biological resources. But, you know, there are choices that have to be made, I think. This is one of the mounds. I wanted to show you this so that you wouldn't get the idea that only China has monumental, enormous sites. This is the burial of the Emperor Nintoku around the end of the 400s in Japan. This is taken from a jet coming into Osaka Airport. So this gives you an idea of the scale of this thing. You see the factories over here, the houses all around this. Here's the road. Here's the tomb. And the tomb is keyhole-shaped. And it's sitting in a moat. And there's another whole moat out here, which is gone through modern encroachment out here. To give you an idea of the scale of this thing, here's a comparison. This pyramid in the middle here is Khufu's, Cheops' pyramid in Egypt. Here's the mound of the emperor of Qinshihuang, which is so big that it looks like a natural hill. And here's Nintoku's tomb. So we mustn't get the idea that because the Japanese islands are small and space is scarce, that they didn't have the cultural resources or the prehistoric resources to build these absolutely monumental tombs. Now, what is really strange in modern, secular, civil libertarian Japan is that these tombs cannot be excavated. They're the property of the imperial family of Japan. This goes back to the 20s and 30s. There are hundreds of these tombs, and in this period of Japanese nationalism, many of them were linked to the royal family. It was assumed that these were all the sacred precincts and burials of the original ancestors of the Japanese emperors today. Now, most people are willing to concede that many of them could not be. They're not the right time period, they're not the right shape. The archaeologists keep saying, let us dig inside and see what we find. And the Imperial Household Agency, who owns these, says, don't you go poking around in these, because if you do, we'll haul you up in court under the same law that we use for disturbing a burial, that is, for desecrating a cemetery, because these are our relatives. And this has gone through the Japanese diet now. This is not small potatoes. They debate this regularly in the Japanese diet, and it's an argument which is a microcosm of Japanese society today. We have the Japanese Communist Party and others saying, why should we keep giving all this money to the imperial family? Look what they do. They won't even let scientists in to work on these tombs. We have no idea of the wealth or the nature of the cultural objects which might be found in these tombs. And so they're sitting there. And the debate goes on. And it's a very rancorous debate. Now what happens is that the archaeologists are allowed in when a fence post is dug, for instance, around one of these tombs. And the Imperial Household Ministry people stand on one side, and the archaeologists stand on the other side and glare. And then when the hole is dug, the archaeologists come over and they look inside and they say, nothing there. And the Imperial Household Ministry says, we told you so. And then that's it. And this thing goes back and forth and back and forth. And so we don't know. Some people, the Koreans in particular, speculate that the Japanese imperial family is worried that they will find objects of Korean origin from the 5th century, and that this will somehow confirm a very strange notion that is going on in history and archaeology, that the Japanese royal family in the 5th century may have been Korean. Now, I believe that there's no doubt that they borrowed many cultural traits that they traded with Korea, but I don't think that the evidence is very strong that they were actually Korean. The question of whether they were actually Korean is a very difficult one because Korea and Japan did not exist at that time period. It's like talking about someone being French or German in the 4th century AD. Those terms really are modern terms that have been used to confuse and color the issues. But this is a big issue in Japanese archaeology which we should all be aware of. I think some of you have seen it written up in the Far Eastern Economic Review in the last few months. This whole problem about who has access to these cultural treasures within Japan and what is the role of the imperial family in this entire problem. Actually, one of our undergrads, Yuri Watanabe, is preparing an article now for publication on this. She's done the research on the archaeologist side. Now she's trying to find books written by the Kunaisho, the Imperial Household Ministry, which gives their side of the question. Now, the last Japanese find that I want to look at is this very, very strange find of an inscribed sword that came out of a burial mound. This is a keyhole-shaped tomb. It's much smaller than the ones we've been looking at. Sitting here in Saitama Prefecture, which is outside of Tokyo, and this site was excavated in the 60s. Actually, they made the whole thing into a big park. They've been doing a lot of this. In order to save the burial mounds, they take the whole area and they landscape it, they put a museum in the area, and they make it into a local park. Again, many Japanese archaeologists are not convinced that this is perfect yet because they're saying we should not always emphasize burials. We should have other kinds of parks. And I think they have a good point, but this is certainly a great start. The archaeologists had found the burial of a chieftain, and by his side were his weapons, iron swords. Now, iron swords, when they're buried in the ground, they may, you know, or steel, they may have been magnificent originally, but they just turned to rust. And so they saved the rust in the museum, and nothing more happened, until a researcher decided to X-ray these pieces of rust to see what was inside them. And what they found was a gold inlaid inscription of 115 Chinese characters under the rust. And they've now cleaned that away, and this has become the very famous Inariyama sword, which is a topic of enormous debate in Japanese archaeology. This sword, apparently, was an heirloom which an important chief in Saitama had made to commemorate his service to the king of Wa. At that time, Japan was called, one area of Japan was called Wa. And this person on the sword in 115 characters, which are beautifully legible to people who read these difficult characters, says several things. First of all, it mentions the genealogy of the lord that that person served. It gives seven generations of genealogy. The son of the son of the son of the son of the son. And then this person finishes off by saying that I have served this person and my family are a particular group of people who are related, they're military officials, to the king. Now, the date is probably 470 or 530 AD. It depends on how one reads the calendrical dates. And this pushes back our knowledge of the use of Chinese characters in Japan an enormous distance. And these characters apparently are part of a list of characters that was known to have been sent from the king of Pekche in Korea, one of the Korean kingdoms, to the Japanese when the Japanese began to learn Chinese characters and to use Chinese characters. From the style of the sword, some of the archaeologists think that it had been kept three generations before it was buried. There are a lot of controversies about this particular sword. But what makes the story particularly interesting is that another sword, which was found in the 20s, which has very few characters on it and which couldn't be read, from Kumamoto, way down in southwestern Japan, refers to the same king and is from roughly the same time period. So what the Japanese archaeologists are believing now is that in this time period, at the end of the 5th century, the Japanese state extended all the way from near Tokyo down into Kyushu, and that all of these lords were political vassals. So they've got a notion of the whole scale of the Japanese state from this discovery of the Inariyama sword, as well as learning a lot about how many characters the Japanese had at that time and how well they could use them. The Japanese historical documents themselves don't exist until the 8th century. So this is really something then for us to find this early material. This is simply an analysis of the different kinds of characters that have been found, and the archaeologists now are fairly sure that they're all part of this group of characters which came from Korea. There's one other very weird object, this one, with these seven sort of spikes on it, which apparently was made in Korea about the same time period. And the people who study the origins of Japanese writing say that it has characters on it which were not sent to Japan. There's a wider range of characters that the Koreans had at that time period. So Korea was a kind of transmitter of literate Chinese culture to the Japanese at this time period. Now, I want to shift finally to deal with Korea itself. And I've put Korea at the last to show it as a kind of bridge. Korean archaeology is one of the most fascinating areas right now. It moves very, very quickly. Particularly the Republic of Korea, we know relatively little about North Korea. It's very difficult to get information from North Korea, but I understand that we're on the brink of a very new sort of diplomatic era as North Korea begins to attempt to follow the pattern of China, to sort of liberalize its foreign policy, and we may see more. Now, this is the royal cemetery of the Silla kings, S-I-L-L-A, and there are these huge burial mounds. They're famous, I think many of you may know these. They date from about 400 to 600 AD, and they're famous for their gold, these incredible gold crowns. They are literally dozens of pieces of gold. Right now at UBC, four of us have taken a list of 125 tombs. We have 97 different kinds of objects, not counting the pots. That's only counting the metal things. And what we're doing is a cluster and scaling analysis of these tombs to try to see whether we can find groupings within them that we're hoping will tell us how many ranks there were in the society. That is, how many different echelons of royalty and nobles were there. We're in the process of working this out. And some of these grave goods are really incredible. We're working at them now on a kind of abstract level, but it's really hard not to appreciate them when you see them. A student from UBC, Ko Wan-young, is now in the midst of a very, very elaborate study in which he's tracing the origins of the crown. And one of the things he's found is that these relate actually to the shaman's headdresses of the Samoyed people in Siberia. And it's suggesting that there's a whole sphere in this area of these kinds of headdresses. Now, we don't know which way the influence is going or how it's going, but these may well have been burial crowns that were worn by religious practitioners in the society, not necessarily the king. We still don't know some of these things. But there's only one facet that I want to show you tonight, and that is that although the gold is overpowering, the Koreans found glass in these tombs, and the glass is quite unusual. The glass is not made in China. You might say originally, you know, right away, it must be traded from China. This is glass which is coming to the southeastern part of the Korean Peninsula in the 4th and 5th centuries from the Mediterranean. And the trade routes are really quite incredible. This is a piece of Persian glass which has been found, actually in what is called the Phoenix Tomb. Now, the Chinese are writing about this today in the last few issues of a journal called Kaogu. They're starting to do the analysis of the glass. There actually was a piece of plate glass, which I didn't mention, in the King of Nanyue's tomb. That tomb in Canton City had a piece of glass in it. Chinese aren't quite sure what to do with that yet. It's not locally made. The Chinese could make glass. They were fascinated with glass, but it was never like porcelain or jade, as far as they were concerned. And so glass came into China probably beginning around the beginning of the Christian era and later. But what many Korean people think, and Japanese and others, is that The Korean people at this time had an independent trade route that ran north of China. The Silla people have been pointed out in paintings in Samarkand. So they are known to have had envoys that went apparently at least partway on the trade routes. Now, it's really hard to believe that the trade routes didn't come into China. How could the Chinese have allowed this sort of trade to go along their border? But there is this very tantalizing suggestion. And one of the things that anthropologists have become interested in the way in which states evolve, is the impetus which is given through long-distance trade, the trade in these elite objects. Whether they can actually sell them or not is another question, but it reinforces their power, particularly their sort of ritual power. Now, look at this object. This is found in a tomb that is called the Hwangnam Tomb 98, the Hwangnam Taechong in Gyeongju. And it's from Hellenistic times, actually later than that, I'm sorry, Persia. And what's really interesting is it's been mended with gold wire. Somebody must have caught hell when that got dropped, I can imagine, or broken. And it's ended up as an heirloom in the Korean tomb. So these objects, at first, were real puzzles. The Korean archaeologists would simply say, we found so many pieces of glass, and that was all they would do. This piece has actually been analyzed in Tokyo. They've done some of the analysis on it, and they're sure now that it's, I made a mistake earlier, Sasanian. And there are many examples of these, but not very many in China, with this kind of phoenix shape. And they're a real puzzle. So we have so many new things to learn. This necklace came out of a site about the 4th century in Gyeongju as well, the same royal area. What we've done at UBC is we've made a big map of the Gyeongju Basin, and we're starting now to see whether we can find whether all the burials of one kind are in one part of the valley or in another part of the valley. It's real magic. You know, every day you get something new. Mind you, it's all written in Korean, and I don't read Korean, so I have colleagues who tell me what's in the reports, and we translate, and then we go back and forth. So that also makes it, I think, doubly exciting. Now, sorry, the third bead. Actually, we have to go back just for a moment here. The third bead up on this necklace looks like this. It's got an inlaid human face in it. And again, I'm told this is only done in the Mediterranean world. So this is 4th century. And it has apparently been traded through ways that we'll want to know more and more in the future, from hand to hand. How that trade happened, who knows? Right across the old world, from the Mediterranean to the edge of the Pacific, almost. Now, the last site I want to look at, sorry to take so long about these, is the discovery of a shipwreck in 75. And this is the Shin'an ship, which was found actually off Mokpo in southern Korea. And this was a ship, apparently, that was on its way to Japan. That's what most people think now, around maybe 1320 AD. And it went down. Shin'an means new peace, and it mustn't have been very peaceful in the sea at that time, I think, when this boat finally went to the bottom. It's lying in 60 feet of water, very, very muddy, cold water. The Koreans had a terrible time working on this. They worked for several years, and they now can tell us a little bit about the ship. They've also found, by the way, another ship off the China coast that is a little bit better preserved. And they think the two ships are similar. The China ship, the one in Fujian province, is 34 meters long, 9 meters wide, has a hull depth of 3 meters below waterline. So 3 meters below waterline and a displacement of 370 tons. These are apparently equal to the largest trading ships in the Western world of this time period. These ships were plying the East China Sea. The Shin'an ship was found to have watertight compartments in it, which is different, apparently, I'm told, from the Western ships. They actually made sections of these ships. It had on it a load of mahogany logs, apparently. Now, you know, where those came from, they're coming up the China coast, or maybe from Southeast Asia, on their way to Japan. And it had, in the hold, some 2,000 Chinese coins, which were found first. And later on, they found 3 tons of copper coins, finally. And literally thousands of superb Chinese porcelains. And what is so exciting about this is that it's one time capsule with a few problems. It seems to be mostly early 1300s, but there are several pieces of Korean porcelain which are 200 years old, older on it. And all that people can think of is that they were dealing in antiques. And they were taking these to the trading port of Hakata, Fukuoka, in Japan, and that many of these objects were destined for the upper class in Japan and for Japanese temples. Many of them were in pairs, and they're a particular style that we can see in Japan. Great thing about Japanese is that compared to other people, they throw away or destroy very little. And so what we can find in Japanese temples today is many examples that we can compare with these sunken examples from the Xin'an ship. These very, very fine celadon pieces, for instance, equal to anything, really, that is known. They've all had to be cleaned. They were covered in coral and other sorts of materials. I think we're just changing the slide tray here. Just have a few more to look at. This jar, some of these have been found in Japanese collections, all made of an iron glazed ceramic that we call celadon, which the Chinese excelled in. And the objects from this ship have been the subject of a number of international conferences. I found a very interesting thing. I think at first the Koreans were rather breathless about this whole discovery. And many of them said, this is not ours. This is a Chinese ship off our coast. And I think they were reluctant, really, to become involved in this whole discovery. Later, they built a whole new museum in Gwangju City, actually. And part of this museum has been used to house this incredible hoard of material. Various wares that collectors are very excited about, ones with overglaze painting on them, for instance. And what's interesting is no blue and white, which we would expect in the 14th century. So apparently, this is just before the Chinese had moved on to the new technique of making blue and white ceramics. These are very interesting. They're mold made, and then they cast them on their, they fire them on their lip. So they set them upside down and fire them in the kiln, and that's why there's no glaze on that lip. And the connoisseurs often covered that with lacquer or with copper or even gold. I think we'll see another example here. These wonderful water droppers. There are very, very similar things found in the Philippines. And this led, actually, some of the Japanese authorities to wonder if this wasn't a ship that had originally been bound for Southeast Asia and had gotten into a typhoon and had gone right across part of the East China Sea and been wrecked off Korea. So there are many, many questions still to be answered about these particular materials. Here's one with a tea bowl that would have been prized in Japan. And it has a copper trim on the lip here to protect that unglazed lip. Now, these all would have been made in the area of China south of Shanghai, Zhejiang province in particular, and then put into a ship and taken up the China coast, we think, on their way to Japan. Now, why do we think this ship's going to Japan? Well, the last object, I think, not this one yet, but the last one that we'll see are some Japanese ceramics which were found. And it's thought that they may have belonged actually to the crew on the ship. These lacquer objects, carved lacquer in perfect condition. Now, the Koreans have spent an enormous amount of effort in cooperation with UNESCO in the recovery and preservation of this particular find. And it has opened up, I think, a whole new area into the study of the Chinese trade. I'm interested in the trade not only for all of this loot, but for what we can learn about the integration of these different societies at this time period. This is a piece which is seto ware. It's from Japan. It's a Japanese copy of Chinese ceramics. And this is the one that has led people to suspect that this ship must have been on its way to Japan from China. Now, in closing and trying to summarize the material that we've looked at tonight, I don't have very many specific points to make, but there is one sort of which I feel is very important, and I think it proceeds quite directly from what we've been looking at. I think that in Canada and anywhere in the West, we really have to take some time and energy to figure out Asian culture and Asian ancient culture, because when we interact with people from East Asia, I think what I hear around me sometimes in Vancouver is that we're willing to sort of grudgingly accept the fact that we have to coexist with these people, but I'm still hearing people saying things like that they're shrewd or they're overpopulated or they're robotized, and that what we really need to do is to figure out how we can close a deal with them. And what I would suggest is that what we have to take is a much, much longer term view. If we can get a sense of their time of history, their sense of time and who they are, then I think we may end up being a little bit more successful in our interaction with people from Asia. I think that no educated person today believes that economics takes place outside of a cultural and a social setting. And it's this cultural and social setting that I think is absolutely key. This is what I would expect of any first-year social science student, really. And I think of most of us, that if we think that we can interact with Asia on some kind of neutral economic level, I think that we're going to be left far behind. Now, I don't want to... I realize that I'm preaching to the converted, that you are the people who are interested in enough to come and to hear and to be appreciate the sorts of things that we're looking at. But I would like to close by saying that I think there's a larger group of people who have to listen to what we have to say. And so, to our government, I would say that the countries of East Asia are not supporting cultural and social studies of the world around them because they are rich and have accumulated a monetary surplus. They are rich and strong because they made the long-term investment in these kinds of study, which they value highly. Thank you.
I think there are people in the other room, but there may not be very many of them, and I'd like to, if I could, by this invitation, to ask them to come here to ask questions and to sit in the aisle or stand while we have questions here. Now, we've gone a little bit over time, but I think it was worthwhile, if I may say. I feel rather stuffed up with information, but are there questions? Yes?
It's a fascinating period of Will there. You had an incredible number of spokes. Can you tell us something about the technology of the wheel? It was 200, about 200 or 380?
Could we have some explanation of the technology in respect of the design of the wheel, which might have had as many as 200 to 300 spokes?
A couple dozen.
Oh, that's better. Okay.
The chariot is from the chin. And there are some major changes, apparently, in the design of the chariot wheels, which took place from the Shang down to the Qin. That is during that last 1,000 years B.C. And I understand that part of it was in lightening the wheel, and there are some changes in the number of spokes. And I'm really sorry that I simply don't know enough about the details. I know that in the exhibition of science, 7,000 years in Seattle, there was some discussion also about the chariot design. There are incredible changes in the way in which the horse is attached to the chariot as well. So that, and I don't fully understand those as either. There's a whole field in the technology of those chariots. And I'm really sorry to pass the buck, but there is actually a book in German, The Chariot in Ancient China, done by a colleague of mine, Magdalene von Duval. And she went into many of the details. There's always been a suspicion that the original prototype may have been from the Near East. And that also has been a very, very complicated issue. I have wonderful images of how you get the chariot from the Near East to China. Whether you ride it or whether you dissemble it, Ted Pulleyblank tells me about driving from Calgary to Winnipeg in a Model Ford in the old days when they went across the prairie. And I have this image of ancient China, too, of just striking out in these. But there are many, many technical details, and there are now specialized studies coming out by the Chinese on these. Another question? Chinese coins. The question is, how old is coinage in China? I've always been astounded at how recent coinage is, because many of the early states in China, for instance, had only shell. And one point that I didn't make is that Nanyue kingdom, for instance, which is already birth of Christ time period, right, roughly, in Canton City, they did not have their own coinage. They were borrowing coinage from other people. So apparently what we begin to see is the use of coinage in the last part of the first millennium BC. So that would be somewhere 500, 400 apparently. And the first ones are things like, they look like knives or other kinds of money, other kinds of utilitarian implements. In the Han, they actually started to make the round money with the square hole in it. But it's also interesting, I think, in the Western world that I think what happens is that until you reach a certain level of a colonial system where you have to have these very standard units which cannot be things in kind, you don't use coinage, apparently. So I was really quite amazed. One thing I might mention, by the way, that is when we speak of knives, the Japanese have just found a cache of 350 bronze daggers carefully lined up absolutely perfectly in the ground in Shimane Prefecture from about 100 AD. And no one can figure out whether those are units of wealth or what exactly they mean. But these things have been purposefully buried in this huge cache in the ground. And some people are beginning to think it indicates that there's some kind of state level of organization in which they're hoarding some standard unit of wealth and distributing it. Other people think that they were hiding weapons. Other questions? Yes?
I'd be interested in your establishing a relationship between the Red River Card and the charity. my question here is that is it all the soldiers that have been discovered, graves and so forth, were there any evidence of any women having been among the soldiers or evidence of any other way besides the concept of the grave?
No, I don't think so, but I'm not absolutely certain on that. I think that what we find when we look at Chinese political history is important women, leading uprisings, but not, for instance, the uprising in the Canton area against the Qin. There was a very famous and important woman who was involved in that, and I think that generally in Chinese history we find these very, very powerful charismatic women arising. But I think that it's true to say that we don't find them at any level in the formal military hierarchy. Now, I am not sure of that, but that's my suspicion. Yes?
Make some general comments.
the question, the comment is that the objection to excavating burial sites is not unique to Japan, that in many parts of the world, in Israel and Canada, people are very much against archaeologists excavating burials. And I worried as I prepared this lecture tonight that I seem to be emphasizing tombs and burials in the selection of the discoveries which I chose. Those tend to be the most dramatic, and they're the ones which are the most reported. In my own mind, I think I see a strong difference between the excavation of a tomb of an important royal person of the 4th century and the excavation of native people's burials today in terms of the kind of feeling of where we're coming from. I think there's a very strong political dimension. I think that archaeologists in general have been irresponsible in perhaps in not conveying to the public enough of the reasons why they feel that it's necessary in some cases to excavate burials. We're not after the sensation of the burial, we're after very often important medical information or important cultural information, and usually we try to show respect for the remains of the human person who's being excavated. I think that in the cultures of Eastern Asia, we also see a difference. The people who are excavating the burials are of the same ethnic origin and the same, how can I say, political power group. And I think that in North America, this has been one of our very difficult and tragic situations, that what has happened is that we've seen the Euro-American or Euro-Canadian culture, the archaeologists, excavating Indian remains, and that has been seen as a kind of political statement of subjugation. Well, this is an enormous problem which runs through archaeology in my mind, that in the old world, this is why I think that we see the Chinese not being particularly worried about excavating burials, even though no modern Chinese person would want to tamper with a recent grave. But there's a political difference and a social difference, that those people are in control of their own situation, and they're also of the same ethnic group. One of our problems, I think, in North America is, and this is one of the reasons why I think that archaeology is treated differently. You know, in Japan, for instance, archaeology is part of the Board of Education. In BC, I'm not joking, it's been under recreation, it's been under highways. We don't know what to do with it. We really don't. And it's not funny. We haven't yet to come to terms, I think, at a deep level with the archaeological resources of this new country of Canada. But I think that that's the difference, that there is this ethnic break between the people who are doing the studying and the people who are getting studied. And that's the problem, I think. I cannot bring myself to think of the Japanese royal family as a victimized minority. But maybe that argument could be made. I don't know. Yes?